Has it ever occurred to you to feel sorry for Pontius Pilate? You know, it's not the typical reaction. It's not the most normal. But really, if you stop to think about it, if you look at this from his perspective, you have to feel at least a little sorry for the guy. Granted, I mean, he's a careerist politician, and there's only so much sympathy you can have for folks like that. But still, he's trying to make a career of it. He's trying to work his way up the ladder. And in the first place, he gets sent off to the most fractious, troublesome, and generally ungovernable province in the entire empire. It's not, I mean, you have, if you want to work your way up senatorial level, whatever, you've got to go through the provincial governor stage of things, and that's just a really rough place to have to do it. And by the time that our passage comes around, he's already on notice. He's already, a few years before, mishandled one incident and managed to provoke an official complaint from the local leaders, which means that if they send another one off to Tiberius Caesar, who is his patron and his boss, ultimately, of course, that he could wind up being recalled, and that would be the end of it. So he's kind of under their thumb just a little bit. If they choose to, they can wreck his career, and there's really not much he can do to stop that. So, yeah, he brought it on himself. I only said maybe feel a little sorry for him. But he's trying to do his job under these conditions, inauspicious. And all of a sudden, those same local leaders come to him and demand that he take this poor schmuck that they don't like because they got a disagreement about Jewish theology and put him on trial. Now, Rome doesn't give a hang about Jewish theology, and they don't care in the least about whatever screwy, stupid arguments, you know, these half-civilized folks might come up with amongst themselves, their strange views of God and all that. And Pilate, of course, doesn't care the least little bit about this either. But, you know, these infuriating old men are standing in his office and they're telling him that if he doesn't take this poor guy and put him on trial and kill him off, that they're going to get him fired. And so, you know, he puts up with it and, you know, he brings the guy in and interviews him a couple of times. He's not really very cooperative, but there's nothing from a Roman point of view that he's done wrong. And he keeps trying to find some way out of this because really, I mean, why do you want to execute an innocent man if you don't have to? Not that Rome cared all that much, but still, if you don't have to. Yeah, and of course, his wife has the dream and says, don't mess with him. But, you know, they keep pushing and they keep pushing and they keep pushing. And finally, he says, you know what? I'm done with this. Washing my hands of the whole deal, Matthew 27, a little bit before we read this morning. And he says, you go do what you want. And they drag him off and they flog him and they run through the whole nine yards and crucify him. And that's the end of that. Except, no sooner does Pilate think he's finally done with the whole thing, he gets some peace, than these same infuriating old geezers are back in his office. As if it's not enough that he executed the guy for him, right? No, now they want him to guard the tomb. I mean, guard the tomb. You might as well guard a manhole cover. What do you want to guard a tomb for? But he has to deal with them somehow. And he has to keep him happy. And there's a little dispute over what he did. The Greek literally just says, have a guard, which could mean a couple different things. And a lot of our English translations say, well, you have a guard, you got your own, you go take care of it. But from the whole context of the thing, I think it's really pretty clear, not least the fact that the chief priest had to buy the guard off and tell them they'd keep the governor off their backs, because Roman soldiers, if you fell asleep on watch, you were executed. That's all there was to that. I think it's pretty clear that, in fact, the NIV has the right of it, that he gives them what they want. He gives them a squad of Roman soldiers to seal and guard the tomb. Now, you got to understand something. The Roman army at this point is the greatest fighting force on the planet. And there is no second. A squad of 16 men was organized to be able to keep watch in four watches of four through the night to ensure that the watches weren't too long and that there was always someone to stay wherever you needed and others to patrol. serious redundancy going on here. For that matter, a squad of 16, if they were isolated from the rest of their legion, was supposed to be able to form square, four men on each side, and hold that square of ground until help arrived, whenever that was. They weren't supposed to drop until they died of thirst. So, a squad of those guys, and granted, that picture makes them look a little silly. There's only so much you can do about that. These men were well-trained, they were well-equipped, they were well-disciplined, and they were ruthless. 16 of them against 11 surviving disciples, this was serious overkill. This is way out of proportion to any reasonable threat. Which makes you ask the question, why? What are the Jewish leaders so afraid of? And they give their reason. They claim that they're worried about a hoax. They're afraid that the disciples are going to go in and they're going to steal the body. Really? Does that even begin to pass the smell test here? To quote the Presbyterian pastor and author Frederick Buechner, in the not so long run, religious hoaxes always tend to burn themselves out. As the chief priests and Pharisees had good reason to know, living as they did in an age when would-be messiahs were a dime a dozen, even if the disciples were successful in their theft of the body, and even if, for a time, their claim of resurrection flourished, it could not really flourish long without something more substantial than merely rumor to feed upon. The threat of a hoax, at most, would have been as temporary as all the other messianic movements that were flowing through, most of them already long forgotten. Such a threat would barely have been worth the trouble of them just posting their own guard, let alone going to Pilate. Now, that's what they say. That's their official reason. That's their cover story. But there's got to be something else going on here. Their real fear has to be something deeper. Something that they're not willing to admit to Pilate, to that hard-shell old Roman rationalist, and something that they probably weren't really willing to admit to themselves. It's ridiculous, but, Jesus had worked some powerful miracles, and he'd said he was going to come back to life. What if somehow he actually did? What if even killing him wasn't enough to stop him? I doubt any of them had the courage to face that fear, even for a moment. I'm sure they would have laughed in the face of anyone who dared suggest it. But for them to go to such absurd lengths as this. This is the equivalent of a platoon of the U.S. Special Forces here. To go to those kind of lengths, this is the fear that had to be lurking in the back of their mind. Something that they couldn't stop. Because if you're afraid of a miracle, how are you going to stop it? What can you do but reach for the biggest cannon you can find and hope? But the thing is, they were going about it all wrong. As Buechner continues in the sermon I quoted earlier, a sermon called The End Is Life, maybe it is not as hard as they feared. I suspect that many of us could tell them that all in all, there is a lot one can do in defense against miracle. And unless I badly miss my guess, there are thousands upon thousands of ministers doing precisely that at any given instant, making it as secure as they can, that is, which is really quite secure indeed. The point is not to try to prevent the thing from happening, like trying to stop the wind with a machine gun, but every time it happens, somehow to explain it away, to deflect it, diffuse it, in one way or another, to dispose of it. And there are at least as many ways of doing this as there are sermons preached on Easter Sunday. And he's right. You know, as he goes on to say, you can spiritualize the resurrection away without even breathing hard. It's metaphor. It's poetry. It's a way of saying that the wisdom of Jesus' teachings is immortal, like the works of Shakespeare. Or that the value of his example transcends death and lives on in our hearts. It symbolizes the rebirth of hope in the despairing soul. And you know, that kind of thing really bugs me because it misses something very important, which is that if Jesus did not in fact rise from the dead, there's no basis for any of that other stuff. Symbol only has meaning if it's anchored in reality, if it's comes out of something real. And the fact of it is that if Jesus stayed dead, then he's just one more great leader killed off by the establishment. And his story is just one more lesson that really, no matter how much we might like to believe otherwise, the sword is mightier than the pen after all. You know, all too often, we hear people do this. They take the resurrection and they reduce it to a miracle of symbol and metaphor that leaves the substantial reality of our world undisturbed. And you know, I'm with Buechner on this one. If I believed that this or something like this was all that the resurrection meant, then I would turn in my certificate of ordination and take up some other profession. If I thought that when you strip it right down to the bone, this whole religion business is really just an affirmation of the human spirit, an affirmation of moral values, an affirmation of Jesus of Nazareth as the great exemplar of all time and no more, then like Pilate, I would wash my hands of it. The human spirit just does not impress me that much, I'm afraid. And I have never been able to get very excited one way or the other about moral values. And when I have the feeling that someone is trying to set me a good example, I start edging toward the door. You know, I'm an English major. I know about stories. I spent plenty of time in college studying stories. And I'm a firm believer that there's real value in that, that stories like the parables of Christ is the ultimate example, can communicate truth in a very powerful way. But when you get right down to it, if a story is just a story, then it's just something that somebody wants you to believe. And the truth of it is dependent upon the truth and the wisdom and the perception and the honesty of the author. A story this big only matters if its author is God. And it actually happened. If it's no more than a human invention, then it has no power to change the way things actually are. It has no power to conquer the things that we face. And that is the tragedy of modern versions of Christianity. But understand this, it's also the reason for them. Because if we're honest, it's not just the Jewish leaders trying to defend themselves against miracle, trying to hold back God. We all do it, or have done it. We've all done it. And we keep coming back to it, because we're afraid of what it might mean. If we can take the resurrection, if we can take Easter, and reduce it to an affirmation of the human spirit, or moral values, or the importance of hope, or the wisdom of Jesus, then we get to define what that means. In effect, we make ourselves the author of the story. And when we do that, granted, it might not be able to do much for us, but it can't do anything to us either. We've made it something we can control. We've made it safe and tame. The seed of a nice domesticated religion. Miracle pitches us right out of that. Even uncontrollable joy is still beyond our control. And that can be frightening enough. You look at the resurrection accounts, the women were terrified, the disciples were terrified, the angels have to say, don't be afraid, Jesus shows up, he has to say, don't be afraid. And for them, it's good news. But it still scares them out of their wits. Stop and think about it. If Jesus died and came back to life, not even was raised from the dead by another human being, that would be amazing enough. But if simply by the direct power of God he got up with no assistance, with no one making it happen, if he can do that, what is there that he can't do? And what's more, if he did that, if he did all of that for us, with all the horror of the cross, well, if he did that for us, what might he ask of us? I mean, what he said about anyone who would follow me must deny himself and take up his cross, he might have meant that. You know, when he said, love your enemies and do good to those who hurt you, he might actually expect us to do it. You know, not just to memorize it and do our studies on it and talk about what the world would be like. He might expect us to actually do it. I mean, he laid down everything for us. He turned everything inside out for us. How can we possibly accept that? How can we possibly take that seriously without our own lives being turned inside out and upside down? And no matter how positive in some ways that prospect might be, it's still terrifying. Even if life is miserable, for most people, change is still frightening. Because we know in our bones that however bad things might be, they can always get worse. Better the devil you know and all that. And more than that, even when we know we don't have much control over our lives, our egos are still telling us that the answer is more control. Not to give up what little we have. If the problem with our faith is that our God is too small, as I and others have said many times, it's only fair to say that we shrink him out of self-protection. Because Easter, if we face it head on and really think about what we're seeing, shows us a God who is untamed and untamable, that we can't possibly know what he might do. But the thing is, the desire for control is just another version of the primal temptation. The temptation to be our own gods. There's no life in it. It is the road to death. Because if we have control, then nothing can be done for us beyond what we can do. And we can't stop death. A lot of people have tried. No one's managed it yet. The gospel doesn't offer us religion in the comfortable sense. It doesn't offer us a tame, reasonable faith that lets us feel like we're in control and we understand what's going on. Jesus doesn't promise us a safe religion with a God who makes perfect sense to us. The gospel proclaims, and Jesus gives life. Life that has overcome death and will overcome it. Life that takes the 1,001 little deaths that we suffer in this world and transmutes them into seeds of growth. Unless a seed fall into the ground and die, it remains alone. It's only if it dies that it bears fruit. He gives us life that raises dead hopes, that raises dead relationships, that raises dead people. Not only sometimes the physically dead, but the spiritually dead, and that's 1,000 times harder. and not just as they were before, but better. Not merely earthly and human, but eternal and divine. This is the life of Easter. This is the life of the resurrection. This is the life of the empty tomb. Safe and reasonable, whatever their virtues, are limited to the size of our imagination. Jesus is good beyond our ability to imagine, and alive beyond our experience of life. And he calls us to let go our grip on control, to drop our defenses, and let the miracle of the resurrection overwhelm us. Let go and live. Let's pray.